So those 52 reactors, a 10-year life extension, is 250 million additional pounds of demand just from this one sovereign policy. So it's huge. You have to understand these because it does have actual demand implications. Again, it doesn't mean tomorrow, it doesn't mean next week or even next month, but it will matter as things go forward, especially when we get out late decade or early 2030s, which is the period, it sounds like it's far away. It's not. This is the period that utilities are buying right now. So these life extensions have an enormous effect in the 2030s, and it's going to be even more tight than it looks like right now, according to our models. So it's already too late. That's really kind of the story. Like, what we're expecting to happen is already going to happen. We just have to wait for it to happen. Where are we in the cycle? I mean, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I probably would have said we're at inning three or four at that point. I honestly think we're even in an earlier inning 5 years later. I do believe this has an incredibly long runway because of those factors. Demand has doubled in terms of a compound annual growth rate. Supply hasn't responded. So you kind of have to take those facts into account. And yes, I change my opinion when the facts change. So I do think we're still very, very early in the story. What's the upside here? 2x? If things get crazy, 3x? Maybe more? Hard to say on a multi-year time frame. But what is the downside here? Are we going to see spot drop back down to the 60s? No. That isn't going to happen, barring some unforeseen, terrible macro plus nuclear event. Okay. If that happens, we could go back into the 60s. But in under normal conditions and expected conditions, maybe we see, I mean, we just saw risk go pretty strongly off and it dropped to 82. Utilities stepped out of the market entirely, dropped to 82. So are we going to see 60s? Probably not. What is the downside for spot uranium here? 5, 10%? You know, maybe a little bit more in a severe risk-off environment. What is the upside? A double. So it's the risk-reward ratio is very, very attractive here.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. It's me, just Steve Yang here. With me today, I have one of the most respected voices in the uranium space, Justin Huhn from the Uranium Insider. Justin, thanks for being here. How are things with you?
Things are going really well, Steve. Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Justin, uranium's ran up into the 90s, the 100 range earlier this year, and then has cooled off into the mid-80s, you know, where it's kind of been hanging out. You know, what caused that kind of swing, and how are you looking at the path forward from here?
Sure. So the big move that happened in January into kind of the first week of February was largely almost entirely driven by the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust and trading around SPUT. So just right as the gates opened for the new year, risk was on in the uranium space. A lot of money flowed into the ETFs and into SPUT specifically. So they raised almost $500 million in January alone and were able to buy over 5 million pounds or almost 5 million pounds year to date already. So they did a lot of buying. Of course, there was a lot of trading activity. When SPUT is raising a lot of cash, oftentimes traders will front run them, buy a little bit of uranium. That'll be pushing the price up, hoping to sell it back to them a few days or a few weeks later at another $5 or $10 higher. And there's a lot of speculation around that on behalf of traders when there's risk on, SPUT's raising cash. So that was sort of the big story around the price rising. Of course, in the background, the long-term price keeps moving higher. And that's really kind of the main story here. So following that price spike, the market got really backwardated. It spiked, it came right back down into the 80s. Now we're trading right here about 86 a pound. Long-term is 91.50 as a blend between the two price reporters. And a lot of the volume that we saw January into early February in spot has sort of shifted away from the spot market and towards the term market. And we can get into that if you'd like, but the attention certainly right now is on the long-term uranium market.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and do that? Can you give me the difference between spot and term widen? That's so important.
Sure. So the spot market essentially is any transaction of physical uranium that takes place with less than 12 months of settlement. So it's short-term trades. Oftentimes, you'll see utilities in the spot market only when the price gets kind of into a trough. When the market is risk off, when the price drops, utilities usually take advantage of that dip, which they did when we got down to kind of 82, 83 a few weeks ago. There were some utilities in there buying. But generally speaking, the spot market is material traded back and forth. That's most of the volume in the spot market. There is about, I would say, 2 to 3 million pounds a month of actual production, new production coming out of the ground that does get sold into the spot market. That is procured by traders, by financials, and to some extent utilities, depending on how the pricing environment and how that price in the spot market is relative to term. So oftentimes it's described as sort of a surplus disposal market. It's not a market that's super strategic in terms of pounds being sold. So you'll have some traders that have offtake agreements with producers, and they'll get material every month, and sometimes they'll just dump it in at whatever price. So that kind of happens in the spot market. The term market is settlement beyond 12 months, and that's where most of the volume is actually procured by the long-term users of the material, which is the nuclear utilities. So we saw more than 70 million pounds secured in the long-term market in Q4 of last year alone. Keep in mind, we're at about 195, 200 million pounds of burn up of uranium on an annual basis by the global nuclear reactor fleet. So the long-term market is where the real transactions get done on behalf of utilities with direct buying from producers. And then the spot market is sort of where material is traded. You see more financial activity. You see pounds being traded back and forth. And then to some extent, you'll see utilities buying when there's a trough. And lastly, carry trades get done, and that's sort of a term market, spot market kind of glue that sort of connects those two markets. So a utility that doesn't want to pay up to buy a market reference long-term contract from Cameco in millions and millions of pounds, they might go in for 500,000 pounds 2 or 3 years out, and they'll secure that with a trader who will then go in and buy that in the spot market and carry that on their books for future delivery. So that carry trade sort of connects those two markets. But the long-term market is really the most important physical market to gauge the trajectory of where we're at, where we're going.
Justin, everyone's talking about rising energy demand and uranium getting a lot of attention. How much of that is real demand versus just money moving the price around here?
It's definitely a tailwind. I would argue that the biggest effect that the drastically increased electricity demand that we're seeing in many places, most places in the world, especially where there's data centers or where we're seeing developing. So, India, China is, we're seeing a lot of electricity demand growth. And then, of course, in the US and to some extent, certain countries in the EU, Japan, a lot of electricity growth that has more to do with data centers and AI. But all of that kind of put together really is, it's a tailwind for nuclear in the near term, in that it is influencing policy, and we're seeing operating reactors get life extensions, their licenses extended. We're seeing idled reactors be restarted. And then for kind of more of the midterm, long term, as we're seeing new builds being announced and new builds sort of accelerating. And the US is one example of all three of those things. We've seen, obviously, the announcement that the Crane Clean Energy Center that used to be called, I've totally just lost it, right? Lost the name of that reactor right now. 3 Mile Island is now the Crane Clean Energy Center. That reactor is going to be restarting in the coming years with a long-term power purchase agreement with Microsoft. The Palisades reactor is about to restart. The Duane Arnold reactor is likely to restart in Iowa. The VC Summer plant that was under construction about 10 to 15 years ago is going to be resuming construction with new owners. So that's all restarts. Every single reactor that is operating in the United States has either received a life extension beyond their initial 40-year operating license or is in the process of applying for that to receive it. So the whole fleet is getting long-term life extensions out to 60 years, and we already have a few reactor operators applying for an 80-year license for their reactors in the United States. And then, of course, the new builds. Just today, it was announced that they are expecting that some of these micro reactor test reactors set up at the Idaho National Lab will receive first criticality by July 4th, which is under 12 months. That's a huge, huge step in getting these things done quickly. The NRC has gone through major reforms. We do expect to hear announcements of new large reactor builds in the United States. And that's just the US. So near-term tailwind, de-risking of the existing fleet, reactor restarts, life extensions. This is huge for uranium demand. And then long-term, It doesn't affect uranium demand today or next month or even next year, but later this decade, early 2030s, new builds that are starting construction now absolutely will have an effect during this cycle.
Justin, you mentioned the 40-year life cycle or the 60, 80-year extension. Is that how important is it to pay attention to that? And if you can tell me about just kind of what this whole renewal, restarting does for the market a little bit more.
In my opinion, the importance of paying attention to these types of developments has to do with your level of confidence as an investor in the space when it is not doing what you think that it should. So when the space is really quiet, when the equities are dropping because the spot price is dropping, whatever it might be, if you understand the dynamics behind the stability and growth of demand for uranium based on these policies. Like I said, you hear about a life extension, doesn't mean that the utility is going to be in the market buying uranium the following day.
Yeah.
But it does mean that that demand is increasingly de-risked. And as an investor, understanding that makes the down cycles within the longer cycle very viable dips. It's a very tradable market. So it's very important for conviction in the space to have a grasp of what these life extensions mean. Lastly, I would say that this is real demand. It is actual real demand. So just 2 months ago in February, France basically gave blanket approval for almost all of their fleet. So 52 of their 57 reactors are two designs. They went crazy fleet mode back in the 70s and into the early 80s in building these two designs. This is almost their entire fleet. These two designs, they just basically gave blanket approval for both of these designs to operate from that initial 40-year license out to 50 years. Now, each reactor will, of course, have to be assessed, and whatever needs to be shored up has to be shored up in order for it to be safely operated for another 10 years. But that blanket approval, so those 52 reactors, a 10-year life extension is 250 million additional pounds of demand just from this one sovereign policy. So it's huge. You have to understand these because it does have actual demand implications. Again, it doesn't mean tomorrow, it doesn't mean next week or even next month, but it will matter as things go forward, especially when we get out late decade or early 2030s, which is the period, it sounds like it's far away. It's not. This is the period that utilities are buying right now. So these life extensions have an enormous effect into the 2030s, and it's going to be even more tight than it looks like right now, according to our models.
Justin, do you think there's a single catalyst that sparks the next big move in uranium? And if it does go, is it going to be fast and sharp, or do you think it's going to be more of a gradual climb?
Well, the gradual climb, I think, is kind of baked in. I think that's going to happen, catalyst or not. And we're already seeing that right now. So we have the long-term price already moving up a few dollars this year. $90 a pound UxC, TradeTech is reporting 93. So 91.50 blended. That's going to keep rising because we understand the terms of the contracts and the terms that the producers are requiring for the new contracts that they're signing. So the grinding higher is going to happen regardless. Catalysts are more drivers of near-term sharper moves. And there absolutely should be some catalysts towards on an ongoing basis. Near term, we're expecting, for one example, an announcement of multiple large reactors being built in the United States. Does that mean that we'll see spot uranium move on that announcement? Not necessarily, but it's probably going to be a catalyst for the equities. The financials have more and more impact on the actual movement of the spot price. More pounds are held by financial entities right now. And I'm not talking just Sprott and Yellowcake, but hedge funds and other traders and banks that are holding material, buying and selling, mostly buying as a speculation. But I would argue over the next year to 2 years, we're absolutely going to hear, some sort of supply shock type of catalyst. And that is probably going to be coming from one or more of the larger development projects that are vital to supply late decade, early 2030s. And as we hear about those, whether they're seeing delays or whether there's a more acute and disruptive catalyst based on that is harder to say. But basically, because we are so dependent going forward, and I say we, this is the industry, so dependent going forward on actual production coming out of the ground because the buffer of secondary supplies, the buffer of inventories just aren't really there any longer. We're so reliant on that that any disruptions to supply is going to have reverberations into this market. We are expecting that type of catalysts at least once, if not multiple times, in the coming years.
Justin, how much does the cycle matter in your thinking? And, when you're looking at uranium right now, where is uranium in the cycle?
It definitely matters, but it's absolutely been a moving target. I did not expect originally when I was looking at this market for even it to even last this long. But that's going back, 2016 was the commodity bottom. 2017, I started to really research. 2018 was kind of positioning. And during that period of time, we still did not have multiple drivers that we have right now. So, electricity demand was basically flat, especially in the West. That has obviously changed. We've seen finally sort of the climate concerned or let's say the political left kind of climate agenda, green energy agenda has finally embraced nuclear over the past few years. That was not the case back then. The compound annual growth rate in 2018 for nuclear was 1 or 2%. Now it's 3 to 4%. So it's been a moving target, and we just have not seen supply respond how we expected that it would or that it should. The projects that we're expecting now in the 2030s, those should have been built 5 years ago, and we've yet to even see them shovel hit the ground on these projects. So it's already too late. That's really kind of the story. Like what we're expecting to happen is already going to happen. We just have to wait for it to happen. Where are we in the cycle? If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I probably would have said we're at inning three or four at that point. I honestly think we're even in an earlier inning 5 years later. I do believe this has an incredibly long runway because of those factors. Demand has doubled in terms of a compound annual growth rate. Supply hasn't responded. So you kind of have to take those facts into account. And yes, I change my opinion when the facts change. So I do think we're still very, very early in this story.
Does technology, growing AI demand, how does that affect the what inning we're in? And it's interesting to hear you say years later we're in an earlier inning. If you can expound on that, just how much runway do we have?
Well, based on what we can model in our own spreadsheets looking at supply and demand, we can have a very confident take for about a 5 to 7 year period. You get out beyond that, you have to start making a lot of assumptions. And why is that take so confident? Because that's about the time that it takes to build a reactor in the places where they're doing it well. So China, the Koreans that built reactors in the UAE were built relatively close to being on time on budget. So the reactor construction projects that are currently happening now, especially in the East, are happening quickly. So we can look at all of the reactors under construction right now, make an educated guess on when those will be hitting the grid. We can look at the current operating fleet. We can make strongly educated guesses on when those reactors will be shut down or not. Life extensions, restarts, all of these things are baked into the model. So we can look out 5, 6, 7 years and be very, very confident in what demand is going to look like. The supply side is actually even easier because it's a smaller universe. The demand, spreadsheet has 442 reactors right now and 70 something under construction. Much more complex. Supply side, there's 50 uranium mines, 30 of them are operating. 20 of them are in Kazakhstan. So I'm sort of, I'm
Wow.
making a vague assumption here and a kind of a generalization, but you get the idea. It's a short spreadsheet to look at all of the producing mines in the world. You can look at what's actually under development right now. What do you expect to be under development right now? And that is a conservatively confident model on the supply side. So that is to say that the likelihood of supply surprises being sooner or more is significantly less than likelihood that the supply projects will be pushed out and will not be supplying as much as, let's say, the feasibility studies or the market expects. So demand, stable, easier to model, growing, de-risked. Supply, much more risk. And the risks are largely right tail. If we see projects be delayed, if we see actual sovereign stockpiling, and you can't necessarily call the contracts that India just secured with Cameco in Kazakhstan sovereign stockpiling, although that's a state-owned nuclear operator, and those were very, very large contracts. But Sovereign stockpiling, strategic supplies, inventory restocking on behalf of utilities, military demand, and then, of course, supply shocks. All of this stuff is right tail. Hard to see where the supply surprises are going to come from. Will we see some at $150, $200 uranium? Will supply come from places that we're not modeling? Probably. But that's something we'll have to cross when we get there.
Justin, uranium has gone from being deeply out of favor to getting a lot more attention from investors again. How do you make sense of those swings in sentiment? And do you still see value in uranium stocks in the space right now?
I do. Yeah, I definitely do. I think acutely looking right now, it's a little bit of a weird moment in time, not only just with the overhanging broad market volatility with the Iran war, and now we have the broad market at all-time highs. I guess everything is fine. That's got a lot of macro guys kind of scratching their heads. Uranium, the price is stable here. The term market is decently active. We expect that to continue for another month, maybe two. Then we get into kind of the shoulder season, and it doesn't happen every year, and unforeseen catalysts can change that. But usually, May, June, July, or June, July, August are slower. Utilities
Okay.
sort of step back from the term contracting table in a typical year. I don't know that's going to happen this year, but could we see some further downside in that sort of typical pullback, slower season? Absolutely. But even if we don't right here, we're already at a 20% pullback from the highs of a couple months ago. So decent value proposition from a technical basis. If you actually look at the projects that will be producing uranium and generating cash flow, and you price in higher uranium, which is going to happen at $85 a pound, are most of these things roughly fairly valued? Yeah, sort of they are. Some are overvalued, some are undervalued, but vaguely, roughly, generally, fairly valued at $85. You get to 100, 115, 125. It's a whole different story. It really starts to move the needle for these companies that will actually be producing at those higher prices. And those higher prices are incoming. So if you're looking over the valley and you're pricing in the future and trying to discount where the price is going, there's definitely a lot of value to be had right here. With that said, kind of tricky macro environment going into what's typically a slow season for uranium. Hard to gauge the next few months. Catalysts could change that. But yeah, sort of a tricky in-between zone that we're in right at this very moment.
When you're looking at uranium stocks, how do you know when something's actually cheap? Are there checkboxes that mandatory checkbox you look at? What are the things you look at when evaluating uranium stocks? And what things do you look for before you invest?
Sure, that's a great question. The first thing we always look for, of course, is management. Management is number one, two, and three. The projects are very important. Oftentimes, if a project, and this is kind of the case in any sort of mining industry, if the project is good enough, you can sort of have less than ideal management or less than ideal promotion if the project is good enough, but that's pretty rare. So management's important. It's important to look at share structure. It's important to look at outstanding shares, outstanding warrants, and options so you understand what kind of overhang there might be on the stock. I really like to look at stories that are in the process of let's say coming to fruition. So when there's a known project and there's one project and the management has a clear idea of what is going to happen with that project, the market knows it. And you don't necessarily believe that management is going to kind of shake things up or go do some sort of M&A or look at some other targets. That story is kind of known, it's sort of boring. And if it's a great project, that's fine. If it's a mediocre project, there's not really a whole lot of potential value to be had there. So we like kind of that X factor, if you can find it and you can sort of believe where you think management will take the company, let's say. That's sort of a harder thing to put your finger on, but that has led to the biggest winners for us in the past. As far as valuation goes, it's tricky because this market just really operates on flows and momentum more than anything. It's just passive flows into the ETFs, moves everything when it's coming in. Valuation be damned. So, like I mentioned, there are some companies that are severely, in my estimation, severely overpriced here and overvalued. But that doesn't affect the stock. When the money flows into the sector, those companies just keep moving higher. It's liquidity, it's momentum, and it's passive flows. And so to avoid certain investments based on the PE ratio, for example, or based on their enterprise value relative to the pounds in the ground of their assets. Those can be used more efficiently in engaging relative valuation to peer companies, in my opinion, than whether or not it's a quote unquote buy or sell. The signals for us that are more buy and sell signals, and we have a trading portfolio we call the dynamic model, which we trade in and out much more frequently than our more kind of fundamental based buy and hold portfolio. That model uses three different signals, and we take those signals into account to gauge buys and sells. And that is sentiment. And this, of course, is objective, or I should say subjective, but I would say I have a pretty good angle on sentiment based on looking at, for example, the replies to my posts on X or the replies in YouTube videos or things like that. It gives me a very good gauge of sentiment. Sentiment has, to your point, has drastically improved since last year. The lows of last April were terrible. Since then, it's been significantly better. So sentiment highs and lows are trading signals. Very important, what is happening in the physical market. So if we see, and then of course the charts, right? RSI, daily RSI is a big one. If we see the charts pull back 30, 35%, we see RSI get down, you know, below 30 or even below 25. If it's below 20, it's usually a screaming buy almost in every case. Low RSI, terrible sentiment, and the physical market is giving us signals that it's not about to go on a run higher. Those three things combined are pound the table, buy with both hands signals. The opposite is true as well. When sentiment's really good, when RSI is high, when the physical market is moving higher, but it looks as if it's going to peter out. And that's a very hard thing to gauge. You have to have access to that information. Very few people do. So the physical market, sentiment, technical signals, those dictate our trades in and out. As far as which companies to buy, you know, we have our own internal metrics, but of course, looking at the project, looking at the company, looking at the management, and engaging whether or not that company is going to provide some type of accretive M&A or kind of X factor in the futures is really where the secret sauce is.
Justin, you've become one of the main voices in uranium, one of the most respected that I follow, and you've called it an asymmetric setup. If you could expound on that a little bit, and you know, what risks are you watching and looking at when you assess things?
Sure. So the asymmetric setup really, in my opinion, has to do with just kind of a risk-reward ratio. The risk here, and you could take something like Sput as an example, is a good one, because that's kind of the pure commodity. Of course, the mining equities will have more volatility, but betting on the commodity itself, well, you might not have the returns of, let's say, a drill play that hits a strong intercept during a bull market for a commodity that might go on a 5 or 10x run or something like that. Sput, $85 a pound here. What's the upside here? 2x. If things get crazy, 3x, maybe more. Hard to say on a multi-year time frame. But what is the downside here? Are we going to see Sput drop back down to the 60s? No, that isn't going to happen, barring some unforeseen, terrible macro plus nuclear event. Okay. If that happens, we could go back into the 60s. But under normal conditions and expected conditions, maybe we see, I mean, we just saw risk go pretty strongly off and it dropped to 82. The utility stepped out of the market entirely, dropped to 82. So are we going to see 60s? Probably not. What is the downside for spot uranium here? 5, 10%, you know, maybe a little bit more in a severe risk off environment. What is the upside? A double. So it's the risk reward ratio is very, very attractive here. So the biggest risks, of course, are, well, A, you know, global recession / macro bear market. That, of course, will kind of hurt everything. And interestingly, it doesn't really and wouldn't really affect the demand from the nuclear reactors, because these are large baseload clean energy foundational assets for any grid. So they usually continue to operate during recessions at the normal capacity they're operating at, which means the uranium demand continues unaffected by recession. But that, of course, could affect how the financial entities operate. They might sell their uranium in the spot market. The equities could get hit. So that's definitely a risk. The other, of course, risk that's hanging over the market at all times, very, very low probability of something happening, but a nuclear accident would be bad for sentiment in the equities in the short term. And if it actually led to a Fukushima type reaction, which was to shut reactors down and demand destruction, that would be bad. So those are kind of the bigger risks to the thesis. Besides that, based on our models and our confidence in those models, the upside is much more compelling and much more de-risked. Those risks aside, it looks very asymmetric as far as we can tell.
Justin, we've spoken about spot versus term. We've looked at life extensions. You mentioned the dynamic models that you guys have. If you can just tell us a little bit more about the Uranium Insider, what kind of insider information do you guys have and share, and how can people benefit from your services a bit?
Sure. Well, I should, have a disclaimer. Insider information sounds pretty bad, but the information
Sorry.
that, yeah, the,
That's not
no,
what
that's
I
okay.
meant.
I mean,
That's not
it's
what I
in the
meant.
name, right? So
Yeah,
we should
that's your
have that
fault,
disclaimer
Justin.
anyways. So this is nothing, none of the information that we get access to is not necessarily public, or public behind a paywall, let's say. So we have, of course, a large, contact based in the industry, a very large network that we've established over a 10-year period. So we communicate with fuel buyers, we communicate with utilities, we communicate with uranium traders, we communicate with people across the company and the equity space. So we have a very strong contact base that aids in our understanding of this market, in addition to our own research and just the experience that we've had. So we have a small team behind us that we're always working with on a daily basis. We communicate every day with our membership. I mentioned the dynamic model. That's something we introduced last year. So last February, we introduced that and actually suffered a 15 to 20% drawdown following the inception of that model, because that was February into April of last year, which, if you remember, the tariff tantrum and everything was getting sold off. It was terrible. But since February of last year, that portfolio is up about 104% right now. So we've done very well with that trading portfolio over the last 14 months. We have our own internal models. We share the results of those models with our membership. So that gives us and our membership confidence in the work that we're doing to understand the supply and demand. You have to understand that first and foremost in order to, in my opinion, put money on the table. You can be a technical trader, that's fine. But if you want to have the confidence to buy when there's blood in the streets, you have to kind of understand the mid and the long term. That really n necessitates having your own models or having access to models or to somebody that does have their own models. So understanding the physical market is huge. We do monthly webinars. We have a monthly newsletter that's very in-depth. We communicate daily with data from the ETF flows and the spot flows, in addition to our dynamic model positioning. Gosh, we do a weekly watch list update every weekend where we go over the charts in our portfolios. And I do members only videos. I do about once a week of those videos that go out only to our members, where I just discuss what's happening in the market, do chart reviews and things like that. I always say that if you have money at risk in this sector, you can't afford to not have access to the type of information that we put out. And so you can spend more than what you would spend with our newsletter to get access to a single piece of industry information. From somebody like UxC or TradeTech or something like that, which they do great work. They put out really good price reporting. They talk a lot about the industry, all the news, and all of that. We subscribe to their services, but they don't necessarily give you the investing angle with all of that. And of course, it's significantly more expensive than just our newsletter. So that's my sales pitch. If you have money at risk, you have to have the right information, because the sector is notoriously extremely volatile. To be able to trade it or to put money to work when there's blood in the streets and everybody is pulling their hair out, and the sentiment is terrible, you got to have confidence in where the market is heading.
Justin, can you share your website and how people can find you, your socials, and reach out to you if they have any questions?
Of course, yeah. UraniumInsider.com right above my head, and at Uranium Insider on Twitter slash X.
Justin, thanks for getting on the show and sharing your thoughts as always. Everyone, be sure to check out the Uranium Insider. I'll provide Justin's links in the show notes. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. This is just Steve Yang here with Natural Resource Stocks. Always stay smart. Stay curious, stay disciplined. Justin, thanks again.
Good advice. Yeah. Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate it.